see so many, despite the very, very strong sessions that there are in parallel against this and lunch and so forth. I'm William Heath. This is Chris Adams. We're going to talk for a bit about Midex, and then Ulri is going to speak. Just to start out, this always happens, but it's a particularly extreme case today. How many people are aware of ideas like VRM? How many people have heard of Midex? Okay, so that's quite a lot, and also basically we have some of the world experts on it in this room. So the extreme discrepancy in knowledge levels, I would say, is perhaps higher than I've ever known it to be. Chris, do you want to advance, or should I push?
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, when I think of open tech, I think of a bunch of self-determining, aware geeks, capable of doing stuff, who get very, very frustrated by things that strike them as stupid. In previous open texts, we've had presentations on the database state, we've heard from Privacy International, we've heard from Node2ID, we're hearing a lot today about medical privacy and so forth. We've all been frustrated by things like spam and marketing and dysfunctional CRM systems. Midex's research suggests that really anyone who goes online is somewhere in a state of somewhere between in depression and in denial about what happens to our personal data out there. And this is... But this is a community that's used to getting hands-on and doing stuff and getting stuff done and making stuff better. And I think there's a yearning, we certainly sense this in several quarters here and abroad, you know, to build apps on a foundation of trust, where if your personal data is used, it's used in a proper way and with integrity in a way which earns trust. There's people in this room and elsewhere, you know, really focused on how valuable you could build applications to help people manage their health or to manage their finance or shopping, if you could draw on the personal data in a good way. And we all want privacy-friendly single sign-on. We've got a new coalition government here in mid-term. It cancelled its national ID scheme. We've got new ideas for how people get to do ID authentication online. There's campaigns here passed into law about data give-backs, where the government has said, as a matter of law, companies that hold customer records and have to give those structured records back to the individual on demand. That's happening spontaneously in social networks and so on. So there has been this vision with, you know, a couple of the key visionaries in this room about what you could call buyer-centric commerce, which is driven by the individual, VRM, which is a phrase coined by Martin Zard, but used by Doc Searles, Project VRM. We have Doc Searles in the front row who runs Project VRM at the Berkman Center at Harvard, and our colleague Alan Mitchell talks about volunteered personal information, a personal information where a coin I think he termed with Ian Henderson, who's in row 8. This is flows of information emanating from the individual with the individual's participation and connivance. So data protection friendly, accurate, varied about your real circumstances and preferences. The wonderful things you could do if you trusted the system. So that's the sort of presenting problem, which I think lots of us have seen.
Sorry, I might have the clueless ones. What is VRM?
Yes. I'm so sorry. that was the first mistake I vowed not to make. So the sense is of a polarity shift, of a problematic environment where organisations control personal data. And to control personal data, they typically use CRM systems so they can do customer relationship management. And the counterpart of that would be if the individual had a system they could use to manage their vendors in American parlance, hence VRM. Other terms exist. And there are semantic arguments about whether it's a good thing or not, but we won't start going into that. So when we say VRM, it's invoking the idea that the individual is a point of integration, that they can act in a structured and predictable way with lots of organizations. You can connect to organizations. It can be on terms and conditions that are friendly to you. That's VRM. There's a good article about it on Wikipedia. We'll catch Doc after. A lot. Mm-hmm. So, one of the this is a perception, you know, to which Ian Henderson really is the guy who came up with the notion that there was a missing part of infrastructure in all of this, some sort of trusted social enterprise which simply took away the problem of just trust me with your personal data. And there was a new legal form in the UK which is a community interest company. And that's a legal form of company which deliberately says this is not principally about maximising shareholder value at the expense of everything else. This is a social enterprise. It exists to serve a community. A chosen community is people who use personal data online. And it's regulated. It's a business. You can raise funds and borrow money and try and make a profit. But the majority of any profit made has to go back to serve that community interest. And it's asset locked. So you can't simply flog it to a company on the FTSE or in Silicon Valley. So we felt that this legal form would be a powerful way of expressing the level of trust that individuals needed, that this was being done in the interest of the individual and not simply to maximise shareholder interest. And there's an incubator for social enterprises up in Bethnal Green called the Young Foundation, which had a very visionary director at the time who was very anti-national ID scheme and felt if our retina scans and fingerprints were worth something, we need a new organisation of some sort to look after that for individuals. And that vision was very consistent with the vision of a social enterprise to help get VRM going. And we call that Mitex Kick. Its community purpose is to allow individuals to realise the value of their personal data. We went through a stage of doing a proof of concept so individuals could verify themselves against an external service. We went through the stage of a community prototype where live people shared data with live organisations, going through all the due diligence of, you know, is the IT department happy, are the lawyers happy. This involved three councils, Brent, Croydon, Windsor and Maidenhead. It involved BT, YouGov, and Old Swine Solicitors, the UCL, Direct Marketing Association. So the purpose of that wasn't volume, but it was really scrutiny on what happens when the individual takes charge of their data. And there's a two-way process of flow. What does this mean in design? Where's the technology? What does it mean in law? So working through all of that, we've faced the considerable challenge of getting funded with our limited return model. And that took a really long time. It was very, very hard. But we are now adequately funded. We've built a live service, which is now UK-hosted, unlike a community prototype for Patriot Act-type reasons. It's scalable and ready. So, you know, there are a number of other such initiatives. Some are up live, running already with users. We're at the beginning of being ready to supply this personal information to organisations. And we've won three contracts to do it, which are not yet implemented, but in the process of being implemented. Now, the first one is government went out to tender for ID assurance, saying, we're going to be digital by default. We expect all public services to be done online. For that, we need ID assurance. And it's contracted 8 companies to be its ID assurance providers. Some of them are quite big, like Experian and PayPal and Verizon. And there's an outfit that makes Eurofighters, whose name is just mine.
Cassidian,
that's the one. Household name, the post office, and one of them is Mitex. So the government has held the door open to the idea that its digital by default public services can be driven or accessed by individuals who control their own proof of claim. So you want a service, it doesn't have to be that the service goes off to a credit agency to say, is this person okay? It can be that you produce sufficient proof directly yourself, which you've acquired, which is a fundamental difference, subtle but fundamental. So as well as this development in ID assurance, there's been this program called My Data, which is, I believe, the spring of this meme is a guy who tweets as Meme Spring, sitting in row 3, as I understand it, who said, wouldn't it be a good idea? Open data is kind of cool. Wouldn't it be kind of cool if companies gave data back to individuals? And I think because he was well connected to people to whom the Tories were listening at that time, that's a end up in some minister's desk. And he said, yeah, all right, let's do it. And they started ringing around saying, we're going to do this thing. And everyone said, this sounds completely insane. And a month ago, it became law. So the government has passed the primary legislation that can mandate the give back of structured data from phone companies or banks or utilities or gas companies to the individual, you know, in a structured, reusable form. And you know, that starts to be pretty useful data. And it's all rich as full. Well, all credit, I think. There's a similar program in France, which Doc was mentioning over lunch, similar programs in the US. So you've got a presumption that independent ID is okay for UK public services. You've got a presumption that it's not just Twitter and Facebook and Google that will do data give backs, but that businesses will be forced to do it. The National Health Service is going to do it. So education and job seeking sort of next, if that's the way it's going to go. So you're looking at that tilting, which a lot of people have been seeking for years. I mean, Adriana's been holding these VRM hubs for 7 years now in the UK. So looking forward to the day when this simple tilt happens and really big things are afoot which are going to help it happen. And the world will be quite different than it does. So our first three contracts are with the BBC for viewer data on this experimental service they've got called Space, and for connecting Thames Valley Housing Association to its tenants, and they're going to go through big changes with the advent of universal credit. Those two and the government ID assurance. So I want to try and convey here, it's a sort of a lesson that we learned along the way, which is anecdotal rather than kind of empirical. And we thought, a lot of people have sat around, inspired by the work of Doc and others, to say, well, this is obviously, it's got to happen, but how is it going to happen? And many of us, I think, completely misread not what will it be like when it's actually all happening, but where does it start? And I've tried to express here, we thought that organisations were going to be completely pragmatic about this, and when you could show this would save them money and be more convenient, because it would introduce trust and therefore bring the opportunities, they would say, that's logical, we will do it. And we also thought, because we hang out in places like Open Tech, where people campaign against ID cards, that if individuals felt it was fundamentally a better thing to do, they would just go in droves to do it. And I think both those assumptions are wrong. We can go to the next slide, because what we found when we did the community prototype is that for the individual, it's entirely about convenience. It's not for nothing that a billion people use Facebook. If it helps you get done what you've immediately got to get done in the instant, then that's what people will do. And the process of, is it actually the right thing to do, and is it actually safe, and what are the implications of it, that plays out over months and years. So you can get that right, but that isn't a motivation for people initially. And then we also found with organisations, I mean, yes, it is perfectly rational for organisations to, well, as Doc puts it, you know, a trusted customer is worth more than an imprisoned one. I may have got that wrong.
A free customer is worth more than a captive one.
A free customer is worth more than a captive one. You could make that argument philosophically and practically, and you could say technologically it's possible, and you could die in the process of taking this through middle management of large organisations. But actually, there's also something so profoundly right about trusting the individuals you deal with, that quite a lot of organisations would operate in that way. And indeed, some of them are very quick to make that decision, and that's more like a 10-minute decision than sort of, you know, several years and die. And I think that's why we've started with organisations like UK Public Services in Transformation and the BBC and the Housing Association, who, you know, instinctively agree that you should treat individuals with respect. You shouldn't sell their data to Bupa for 140 quid. Sorry, all our health data to Bupa for 140 quid. That's not a, you could have driven a slightly harder bargain than that, I'm not thinking. Or EE, you know, selling, is it 20 million, 27 million subscribers' data to fire Ipsos Mori to the Met Police and stuff. You know, we live in an age where individuals are going to basically find out what companies are up to, and if we don't like it, they're not being. So, when these two things are all in place, I think it's going to spin like a Catherine. But three things are: convenience for the individual, return on investment for the organisation, which makes a decision on ethical grounds, and then it's developer participation, and that's really what it's all about. Because as Chris has already shown at the MyData hackathon, once you've got flows of personal information, you can do wonderful and interesting things with it, very innovative things. And, you know, more far-sighted thinkers, Doc's book, The Intention Economy, comes to mind, sketch out that effectively there is an entire economy, an entire online economy to be rebuilt based on formally permissioned, trusted data from individuals. And that's the task which developers, particularly entrepreneurial developers, are going to set out to do and have a great time doing. I think at that stage, I hand over to Chris.
I think that was the plan.
Okay,
yeah.
Well, there you are. I'll sit in the front row.
Okay. Right, hello everyone. My name's Chris. I joined MyData about a month and a bit ago, actually, largely from getting involved in going to the VRM Hub meetings from that I mentioned about Doc and through Adrian and various things like that. I'm going to talk a little bit about why. I'm going to try and burrow through this fairly quickly because we've got about 10 minutes left. So I'm going to touch on these points here about what things we've learned and what approaches we're taking, which are probably worth adopting or people might want to try using themselves. And then I'm going to open the floor to questions because there are people who've been thinking about this far longer than I have. All right. So there are kind of three areas that are quite difficult to actually address or deal with, right? Storing personal data, managing permission and consent about that, and actually having accuracy and timeliness of this data if you're working as a developer and you're trying to build or use this data yourself. The thing I kind of learned when one thing to actually pick up on when we're working with personal data is that as soon as you start storing someone's data, you then actually take on the responsibility for securing it. So and security, I don't need to kind of tell the group here that security is hard, all right? There's so many ways to get it wrong. So I think there's a few lessons you can actually learn from your approach to data that is very similar to the approach that I might take when, well, no, the approach I take to Zipcar with driving, for example. I don't need to own a car to access the good parts of having a car. In the same way with Amazon, I don't need to buy servers or own everything in order for me to access that and benefit from actually having use of that. We kind of think that there's a kind of trend towards that with personal data storage. And that's partly some of the points I was trying to get across here. One approach we've taken with MyDex is basically allowing API access on data for this. One thing that we're doing, and I'll probably get to that a little bit later on, another thing we're actually doing is we've basically had to do some legal acrobatics to make this actually possible. But users are actually, we basically treat users as their own data controllers. We have no actual access to the data on the platform that we've actually built. So as a user, you're the person deciding how this data was actually processed with other people. And I'm not a lawyer, I need to stress that, but it was no mean feat, but it's a really, really fascinating, interesting law to go through. I've got a list every single time I say, actually, I have to buy William a pint.
10.
So, yeah, 10 pints. So,
no average.
Oh, dear. And one other thing that we're trying to actually do about the trust aspect is actually not only allowing people to actually be their own data controllers and actually have... Oh, there's another pint. Access to that is allowing these stores of data to be moved away. Woo! Yeah. To be moved outside of the platform that we have here. God, that's really... I'm gonna be a poor man by the end of this. I'll touch on that a little bit later. Here's an example of what some of this looks like. So, okay, this is William's. This is some of his personal data store. There's certain aspects of his life that he might want to actually share. So, this is some personal information here. Maybe birth details, driving license. Making this available over an API, as in, I have a connection with this organization, and I'll allow them to. I'm prepared to share some information with them, but I'm not going to dump all my data with them straight away because, to be honest, that doesn't work particularly well for them, and I'd much rather have control over how that's actually working. This is kind of what we're working with at the moment. And this is touching on the idea of informed consent. I mean, when you actually work with, if you're using, say, a service from other startups or Facebook, okay, show of hands, who has read Facebook's terms of service and privacy policy here? Okay, wow, this is like a really engaged audience. We have maybe 2% of people looking at this. So we thought, well, rather than actually putting the burden on actual individuals to do this, one other approach you can take instead is to have one very, very individual-friendly set of terms and make people who actually want to interact with you use yours. Right, so that's the approach we're taking here. And by working with, say, GCloud now, so this is a new kind of contract framework, this means that these kind of human, individual-friendly terms of service are now something that could be adopted by, 33,000 organisations?
Yeah, that's the number of organisations who can now take that service through GCloud and can't change the T's and C's.
Yeah. So these are some of the steps that we're actually trying to do with this at the moment. And this is a really, really early version of it, and when you're working with external organisations, you really need to start with stuff like this, but there's lots more interesting thought about this, about what kind of aspects of life you want to present to people, whether you might want to have a persona available to that you might want to show other people, or lots of things like that. The other thing that we actually... Damn, another point is the issue of accuracy and timeliness. Now, in many cases, if you think about the word data capture, right, this comes from... I think part of this comes from the idea when getting data from someone or asking them to kind of share some information voluntarily was very, very hard, and it was a very expensive process. So you had to kind of capture a big load and then kind of hold on to that and store it and then use it at another time, because you're never going to have another chance to actually get that. Damn, another point. Yes. We think this isn't the only way that you could really do this. If I have agreed to say, okay, you seem like a trustworthy organisation, I'm okay with sharing this information, but I'm not going to share all of it with you now, then you get some other interesting side effects of that. So one of them might be the fact that this data, you can pull it when it's actually relevant for you. So one example we built recently was just a hack called Empower Me, right? The idea was that if I'm using something like a kind of personal data store, when I have I can basically speak to an organisation, and I might share certain aspects. I share the idea of verified but limited data with someone, so I don't need to share the fact that I don't know the last time I cried or all this stuff. It might only share the information that's relevant for a particular transaction. In our case, we built something which gives you personalised energy savings advice. So you might want to share that you have the financial means to buy some solar panels or something like that, and that you live in a certain area. But you don't need to tell people about your name or your family circumstances or anything like that. So the idea was that you've got much more control over actually having access to this. This is one thing that another organisation is actually doing. I mean, we're not the only people working with personal data at the moment. Or the idea of personal data stores and people being in control of that. A really good example is actually some people who are working with Money Saving Expert.
They're Row 8, actually.
Row 8. Is there, who's
yeah.
from?
Ian, yeah.
Yeah, okay. So
one really
nice example of this would be the use of the Cheap Energy Club, which is used, which looks, you basically agree to share how much money you're spending on power at a certain time. And every, say, n weeks or so, they'll check that and see how that actually is matching versus what your utility companies are currently spending. And as soon as they hike their prices, you're told, okay, now you said that you don't want to go above this level. Okay, we'll switch you across. Because they already have all that data, they can basically move you to, so you don't get kind of the traditional approach of energy companies being able to whack prices up on you is essentially hacked around because you've got a different way of actually dealing with data. That's kind of some ideas about what this gives you, something you can learn from actually working with data, and you can actually pull it for accuracy and timeliness like this. We've basically got a developer site up now to actually play with our API and things like that. I'm just going to kind of cut this off here quickly because there are people who are world experts here, and I've been speaking for plenty of time here. I'm quite like to kind of throw it open. If there's anywhere that you could invite me to speak with more clarity on this, then I'd be happy to actually field some questions on like with William. Really.
Yeah, we'll do some questions now,
yes.
And then hand over. So, are there any questions at all?
How many points? 20.
Yes.
I guess you talked a lot about how Mindex uses personal data and gives control to it, but have you looked much at the question of what is personal data? Because there's obviously a whole range of views there.
Okay, so we wouldn't say Mindex uses it because we
the
individual.
The way it facilitates the use of personal data.
A Mindex member is themselves the data controller for that, and we can't see it. But I think the question of what is the boundary around personal data is much discussed, and it's just going to have to play out. So one example for this is a newly funded academic project for the hub of all things, and the idea is that all devices in your home start giving information, you collect it. I mean, people are ramming with BMW. BMW want to create intelligent cars, but they think all the data stays with BMW. So there's going to be a sort of market fight or regulatory fight about, is the usage data from devices you own yours or someone else's? Is your location data from your phone yours or someone else's? I think all we can say is, I think all the organisations that are trying to get this process going can say is, when there's infrastructure that lets the individual accumulate this data, whether it's identifiers or preferences or clickstream or data you've downloaded from a relationship with another organisation, I mean, some of it is incontrovertibly yours.
Yeah.
Even Jeff Bezos doesn't know what you plan to buy tomorrow or something. And it's going to have to play out just what that boundary is. But I think that battle's happening anyway with, for example, anonymized health data. You know, Phil Booth will be talking about that later this afternoon. Is it fine for the government to flog, quote, anonymized health data, which probably is re-identifiable, which covers things like mental and sexual health, to Booth? So we haven't got a prescriptive definition which we impose on that. We're mindful of data protection law, and have had this very carefully checked with a legal opinion on the data protection position of it, and we want to introduce this capability in a financially sustainable way and see how it plays out. Is that it?
I absolutely love the idea of reversing the enforcement of consent equation, and I think there are exciting opportunities around that to make something modular like Creative Commons. But on a practical level, and I guess you can clarify the process, are the people who would set that up not already giving vastly more informed consent already? is there not still the risk that if I try and log into Facebook and it says, I'm sorry, your license doesn't actually match our requirements, are they not going to do the same thing that they do now and just click OK without scrolling to the bottom? Is that...
I'm going to ask Doc to comment on this, because he's also got more work going on with his project Customer Commons.
I would like to get anybody who's interested
in it. The first point to say is, it's been commonly recognised that getting these different terms and conditions is crucial. There's been several initiatives doing that. So Ian, for example, was working with the Kantara project. I don't know, Adrian, whether on your Mind project you got as far as terms and conditions and so forth. Doc has this programme, Customer Commons, which is exploring legal implications of it. We take the view that if you contract with an organisation that wants to connect to individuals this way, and they only get the API key when they've contracted, signed a contract, they'll respect the data in a certain way, and that when they get data, it will be in accordance with a data sharing agreement they understand. You have a legal agreement with the individual, it's free to them, they understand how it works. That is one way of starting to solve this problem. And getting those terms and conditions put into the gcloud procurement so that anywhere across government, if anyone connects to individuals in this way, that's the rules, I think that's quite a big step forward.
So it's as much a certification as an actual authentication.
You need to be happy that the organisations that connect are getting appropriate data, as they have to under European law, you know, data which is appropriate for the purpose in hand, and you have to be happy that an app is also getting appropriate data for the purpose in hand, and it has to be transparent to the individual what that is, and that's very challenging in design terms. Doc, do you want to add anything about the browser idea in terms of stuff?
Oh, boy. A couple of things. One is, this is all very new. Okay, so, I mean, the environment we've been living in for the last 18 years is one that Phil Windley, another developer in this space, once summarized in one slide, which is where he said, the history of e-commerce, 1995, invention of the cookie, the end. Okay, that's sort of where we're still stuck. Okay, we tend to think that everything has to be a client or a server, and therefore either a slave or a master, and one side makes the rules, the other assents to those rules, when in fact, and that free contract type agreements are almost impossible. And that particular assumption is a relic of mass marketing and a mass marketing era that assumed that only large systems could really handle things, and that all the civilizing effects that grace our lives are those in which we assent to what large organizations want, because their systems kind of determine how we ought to be. The internet basically blew all that up and said anybody can relate to anybody else in a way that actually harks back to the dawn of civilization and not just to the point where industry won the Industrial Revolution. So we're working out how that happens. There are companies like MyDex that have figured out a way to be in the middle of this. There are many others, like what Adriana started with the Mind Project, that assume that any two parties can do whatever they want with each other. There are a number of different efforts going on in different localities. Just, I think they're all experimental, quite frankly. And we're going to figure this out over time. What we don't want to see happen is either law or practice falling into new grooves that make things even worse than we already have. So that's sort of another...
Two more questions. One question there, and then one after that. Yeah.
So it's just kind of related to that, really, which is that it still seems quite centralised, and maybe that's a necessary place of where we are right now. But
I think it has some of the qualities of a centralised service and some of a decentralised. Our architecture would support people running their own personal data store and their own Freedom Box or their own Raspberry Pi in their front room if that's what they wanted. And the gathering like this one's very conscious there are people who want that, and that's a good thing. But I think if it's to work efficiently and at scale, going, then there are undoubtedly some performance advantages of centralized services. So what we've tried to have a hybrid of those two, which means that it'll perform satisfactorily, but the individual's genuinely in control, and the access control can be scaled up uniquely under the individual's control. But it'll play out that model. And I think how we get this done will... There'll be comparing and contrasting and competing models in terms of governance, location, technology, business model, all of those things. And I think I think the way we generally feel about the way that the different initiatives feel about each other is a bit like how rodents would have felt about each other in the era of the dinosaurs. You kind of look around and say, hey, there's a quite different sort of mammal or rodent or whatever, but the problem is the dinosaurs. The problem is the existing status quo, the huge companies that think it's their job to own our personal labor, governments that instinctively think in that sort of way. And there's a whole set of different initiatives to try to make this polarity shift possible. And I think it's very healthy that they should be diverse. I think it's essential they should be interoperable. And certainly there's the emergence of organisations that would allow them to interoperate. So there's an open identity exchange, for example, which is working closely with the UK government about making ID assurance tokens interoperable. And then there's an initiative which a number of us are familiar with, Personal Data Ecosystem Consortium, like a trade association for companies that want to work in this way. So we've got the places where those rules will be thrashed out. One last question.
Have a question. I mean, I think what you just asked before, I mean, this is quite a biased set of people. I'm coming from the social sciences perspective, and so you've probably been in many meetings trying to convince people. How do you really empower individuals so it just makes sense of this, because privacy laws and all the things that are implicated here, to make that shift from large corporations to really, you know, individuals be in charge of their data is going to take up.
Everything we learned said it's extremely hard to do, and it's not a conversation people want to have.
Exactly.
The conversation people don't want to have is, do you realise how bad things really are? And when you realise that, do you then start to feel motivated to do things differently? You don't get that part. They shoot the messenger first. I think the only way it will work, from our research, is when people can get done what they want to get done in a more convenient way, this way, than otherwise. So the Energy Saving Club, which Ian's been working on, all files behind that, that's something people clearly want to do. And if there's a new way of doing it, they're not so worried about how they do it, it's the fact they're doing something new. With government services, if you can only get your welfare if you do ID assurance, I mean, that's a bit crude, but people will do it. And if housing associations and universities can support a better relationship with their tenants and their alumni more efficient, then again, I think people will do it. But the social scientists are interested in the debate, most people aren't, and we just have to accept that. I think we should hand over now and hear the next talk, and then perhaps there'll be time at the end. We'll see. So thanks very much for your attention.
Cheers, guys. Okay, let's see how we do this.
Hi, my name is Ulrich. I am the statistician at the ODI. So where, as part of my role, I also do a lot about anonymization and questions about privacy.
2 seconds, sorry, man.
That's all right. And so, Chris and William, this was a very sort of practical talk. My talk will be much more on the other side, on the sort of philosophical, and maybe spark new ideas. So I invite everyone very, very quickly to sort of contribute and ask questions and maybe start a discussion. The title is Sense and Nonsense of a Personal Information Security Standard, and you will see if you read, you may or may not have read the abstract, that there are a lot of questions in there, and I do not promise to answer all of these questions, just to set the expectations right.
We good now? Yeah, we're good.
Right, so before I... Let me start with a little bit of a story. And last weekend I was at the Quantified Self conference in Amsterdam, where it's a meeting of a bunch of people who are very interested in their personal data because they collect it and they want to find insights and change their behavior. And it's quite an interesting group. And so these are people who, of course, think about their personal data and think about their privacy, and this is really the starting point. And one of the main ideas I heard a few is tracking an individual is a lot like tracking a company. And this came out of a lot of people's minds. And this can be interpreted in many ways, in good ways and bad ways, but what it really means for me is that can we learn something from the business world? Because what they're saying is that if I run a hedge fund or something, or if I track a company, I can adapt these principles onto tracking myself and sort of understanding how I can measure myself and how I can build in targets or goals or whatever the principles are. And so this is the same idea with the information standard, and we'll see how this plays out. So the problem is, can we adapt this idea of an information standard to the individual. Can we impose or create, or are there guidelines for you when it comes to personal data? You know, if you look at a picture and so, and you have certain standards in place, should you post it on Facebook? Is that okay? Should you post it on some Google service? Is that okay? Can you only store it? Are there guidelines which can guide your decisions? And if you go, yeah. So why do we care? Well, I don't have to tell you, but it's on the internet. So once it's on there, there's no way back. And if you try to take it off, if you go wider, then you get the Streisand effect. So you can look that up. And so if you go further, but there's another reason why we should care, which is the value of personal data. And there did, hold on. There's this paper just came out from the OECD, I don't know who saw it, exploring the economics of personal data, which I'm quite excited about this paper because it puts financial figures onto personal data. Who would like, what do you think your personal data is worth? Now this is based in the US, but what do you think your address is worth, or what your birth date is worth? Anyone want to venture a guess?
$1,800 per person. I think that's what Facebook sold out for the user.
Mm-hmm.
It's a tiny subset of it,
wasn't it? Yeah, yes. Yeah.
This paper has also, very interesting, so I encourage you to look at, was also very interesting figures on illegal data markets, so what is your credit card information worth and stuff like that. Other guesses?
Well,
it's
140
quid for me. That's the whole
country. Well, yeah.
I was just saying, the fact that we can't guess says there's not a real market there.
I mean, this is one point they obviously mentioned. These are only estimates. But if you look at sort of the experience and companies who deal with data, so what the tradings are really low. So your address goes for 0.5, like half a dollar. Your birth date goes for $2. Social security number 8, and so forth. Credit card and bank information goes for a little bit more, but in general, it's really low. It just means they're already extremely. It just means it's a coin. They're so available that you can't really charge much money for it. So this comes back to the question: if people are prepared to pay money for it, even if it's not as much as some people may think it is, should we actively manage our data? And we're excluding here a little bit the people who really don't care because it's hard to convince them. Then it comes back to the question. How do we build it into tools? How do we maybe approach you have with the empowering the user, maybe reversing the terms and conditions? But if someone wants to actively manage your data, where should you go? What are the guidelines? Oh, and obviously there are different types, so it has to be a little bit flexible. There are people who care more, people who care less, people who are a bit paranoid. So what I found from talking to a lot of people is that sort of a very common type is this don't ask, don't care. I don't really want to do it. I don't know where to start. And the only thing I have sort of in my mind is this public-private model that some information is public, which goes onto Twitter and my blog and whatever, and some information is private, which is probably on some Google service or other service or only in my hard drive. But I have a solution for that, which is the ISO EIC 2000-001 Information Security Standard, which you, MIDEX, also referenced, so I'm here to. And if you look closely at this information standard, which is used in the business world, mostly for implementing standards and then to use it as a sort of a brand, as an added value that you can audit it. But if you look at this closely, you will realize that it is really not the solution, unfortunately, because, first of all, you have to sort of pay for it and get access to the information, then you need to understand it, then you need to really find out, can you link it, can you link the ideas, so if you go on, and it all reads like a bit of a tedious business document. So I've thought about this and discussed this, can we sort of adapt the standards that are in there? And the ideas are good, like identify risk and controls in place, make it flexible so different people or different parts of your personal data can be used differently, gain stakeholder trust. So if someone gives you information, then you can tell them, well, I do this and this, and so it's productive, and blah, 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 a lot of other business jargon. But what I got from that is, it's a few inspirations which we can discuss in the short. So one is the idea of labels. So if you use this ISO, they mandate that you put labels on any sort of data you put out there. So you'd say, you can have different categories, maybe a threefold structure that you say public, something that's public, something is confidential or private, which can go out, and something is confidential, which private, which can be within the business, something is confidential, which can only be accessed by a certain group. And these labels, no, hold on.
Oh, sorry.
So these labels, that's one idea that could be used for personal data, that you say, I come up with two labels, public and private, or I come up with three, public, private, confidential, or I do even more, and then I put labels on my personal data, and then I have sort of a guideline. I know this is private information, so this cannot go on these certain services because they are too public for me. For example, I could say I have a set of pictures which I label as private, but I won't give them to Facebook because Facebook for me is a public service. So that gives me a guideline for decision making when I deal with this sort of. Then there's this idea of tidying up in the ISO standard. You don't want to leave information on your desk, and this could also be used for, say, mobile phones. You could have standards that say you'd tell someone, well, if you want to follow this, put a pin on your phone or something like that. And understanding, I think this is an interesting point because a lot of the, as we said, the terms of condition, a lot of them are very unclear. So thinking about this could yield a set of description that tell you, well, if you use Skype, then you have to realize that Microsoft is reading what you're doing, which came out last week. They definitely proved that if you type URLs are sort of checked by Skype and or by Microsoft, whoever is behind. So this, if there are standards in place, you can build sort of a resource where it tells you what to expect, and if you choose a certain template, this is private, what implication does this have? And this is my last slide, and this is where I open. So just to reiterate the problem I want to pose here, are there guidelines? Well, first of all, are there guidelines for your using and applying your personal data? Alternatively, what is really the problem here? Is it that people don't care? Is it that something like this cannot be implemented from a personal perspective but need to be built into tools? And thirdly, can we actually codify it? Is it realistic to write down Facebook, this is how it works, and you should, and sort of build norms around this issue? And this is where I start with the discussion. So who would like to start